From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
May the 4th be with you. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are here, and that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. Your favorite conspiracy quarantine is back, live, and in full effect. Gentlemen, this is part 4 of our continuing series on the coronavirus pandemic. And fellow conspiracy realists, as we said in earlier episodes, we will likely need to create more updates in the future. Since our last COVID episode, published on April 15th, many, many strange things have come to pass. One of the most interesting trends I saw recently is that world leaders are going missing.
Yeah, it's true. As we record today, no one's entirely sure what's going on in North Korea. Is Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un actually dead? Possibly recovering from heart surgery?
Maybe he didn't have surgery at all?
Yeah, or maybe just taking a little sabbatical from public life to avoid contracting the virus?
I mean,
Ben, we were just talking about how, you know, they've kind of made a big to-do about trotting him out at some events where he's visited a fertilizer plant, I believe. And you mentioned finding the footage to be a little on the fishy side.
Yeah, it's not unusual for authoritarian governments to have back pocket footage of earlier appearances and then put it out as though it is current. It's also very strange that the Supreme Leader missed the largest holiday in the country and then just showed up at a fertilizer factory. So I don't know about you guys. It's a real Schrodinger's Kim if we're making dumb jokes. I'd love to hear from you listeners, what do you all think is happening? Also, the president of Nicaragua, Daniel Ortega, has disappeared. They think that that's probably more health concern related, because he's been notoriously concerned with his health after suffering some heart complications.
So possibly holed up in a bunker of some variety.
Similar to Kim Jong-un there. There was an attempted coup in Venezuela. At least 8 people were killed when that went through, or failed, let's say. There's all kinds of weird stuff happening.
Sort of a minor coup, though, right? Only 8. I mean, could have been worse.
Yeah, the guy in charge of that, the guy says he's in charge of it, was an ex-U.S. Green Beret. I did a piece on that for Strange News Daily, but it sounds like, okay, it's weird because we don't have to get in the weeds on it, but the U.S. is saying they had nothing to do with it, and who do you believe, right? I mean, everything's topsy-turvy. Cats and dogs sleeping together. Oil dropped to a negative number. People are paying to sell oil, which is weird. The Navy confirmed that UFO footage. We talked about that, I think. Or the Pentagon confirmed it.
That's correct. And that footage has been it hasn't been debunked, but it's been shown. Several of them have been shown to probably be weather balloons. From a physics perspective, on a couple of videos that have become more and more popular over the last couple of days, which is disheartening, but also good to know, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the ugly truth is always more preferable, right? Even if it's not as cool as what we wish it would be. In short, folks, a lot of stuff has happened. This is what we know to be true as of today, May 4th, as you said, Matt, may the 4th be with you. As we record this podcast, we're going to look at some facts. We're going to dive into the multitude of things just off the edge of the mainstream media map today. What better or more somber way to start today's episode than with the facts? So here are the facts about COVID-19 statistics. We did something interesting here. So we've got the most up-to-date estimates, right? To get a sense of the spread, we're going to give you the numbers from last Friday and the numbers from today, May 4th. So what's going on maybe in the global sense, and then maybe we can dive into the U.S.
Yeah, globally, there have been an estimated 3,327,246 cases of coronavirus across the entire planet as of this past Friday. Today, there are 3,628,851 cases. There were officially 234,702 deaths on Friday. Now we're looking at 251,099 deaths.
Thankfully, there is good news here. As of Friday, about 1,050,000 people had recovered as of Friday. And today we're looking at around 1,184,000 people who have reported to have recovered, which is really great.
Well, it's funny, too, that that's not the number that you see trotted out nearly as much as you would think it should be. I mean, that really is the silver lining there. That's quite a large number of folks that have recovered.
Yeah, it's a number that I personally wish would be reported more often. It's just, it doesn't show up in a lot of news content. Here in the U.S., we see that on Friday, this country had an estimated 1,095,304 cases. Now that number's jumped over the weekend. It's more like 1,184,020. And the number is just tick, 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 ticking up as we record. By Friday, 63,871 people had passed away. That number has now jumped to 69,220. I want to take just a second here because we're throwing a lot of numbers at you, and those can sound, you know, you can get number fatigue or get desensitized to it. But what we're telling you is that thousands of people died just Saturday and Sunday.
I have coined a new term, you guys, number numbness.
There we go.
Yeah. Well, let's just stay in that numbness just for a moment, because I just want to talk about Fulton County in Georgia, where our office is located. You know, we're officially open now. Our state, Georgia, is open. And we are seeing cases in Fulton County specifically continue to rise, and they haven't fallen, and we are now open. So I would just say the three of us are feeling a little extra cautious now, even though our state has decided to open up. And there are several other states that have opened up at least partially. So even though it seems like that, just that concept that a state could be thinking about reopening right now makes you feel a little better, but the numbers are not bearing out positivity here.
Well, and you know, one thing that I believe we mentioned on the previous episode is, you know, the idea of quote unquote opening back up the economy, thinking about it like in big picture, sure, there can be announcements and officially we can be open, but it's ultimately up to people and their comfort level as to how they deal with that opening up. And I was pretty shocked over the weekend in Georgia to see that people seem to have taken this announcement by our governor as a sign that everything's mainly just cool again. I live very close to a big park, and I walk there, you know, for my daily exercise, and walk there over the weekend, and there were just tons of groups of people with no masks, just hanging out in large numbers. And we're seeing images like that rolling in from places like Central Park in New York and Brooklyn, you know, and Prospect Park. And I really feel like, while I think many of us and our friends take this kind of stuff with a grain of salt and like, well, it's up to me whether I decide to, you know, go back and return to normal or not. I think the very announcement of things like this is enough for some people to just decide that, okay, everything's cool again. We don't have to social distance anymore. And that couldn't be farther from the truth, right?
Yeah. At the risk of sounding cold, given what we know about that 2 week time period, I think I'm going to give it another 2 weeks at least. I am not champing at the bit to be the beta tester here. And, you know, again, like to that point about personal responsibility, personal rights, it carries on a larger scale here, because the U.S. has no coherent federal pandemic policy. It does go down to the states. And I think that's something that will keep this process happening for a while. It's lengthening what we would do, you know, as opposed to other countries that have the authority legally to lock it down like immediately. This is a trade-off, you know. We will say that there is a good sign, though, because here in the U.S., despite these openings, 155,737 people had contracted coronavirus and recovered as of Friday. And today that number has jumped by almost 30,000. 181,901 people today are officially recovered. Recent studies from South Korea seem to confirm that you cannot recontract this brand of coronavirus after you have already had it, which is why people are getting the antibody test.
But I've been hearing other things, though. I've heard other studies coming out of China saying that they've seen cases where people have recontracted it or tested negative and then tested positive. Do you think that's more a case of false negatives and then getting a new test that is more accurate or gives you a more accurate result?
Yeah, it's likely. The efficacy of the Chinese-produced testing kits, especially in the early days, is not super great. It's not near 100%. So there have been multiple countries and institutions complaining about receiving broken test kits. There was one country, I can't remember who it was, but there was the leader of one country, I think in the African continent, who said the Chinese tests were bad because he just to test the test, he administered it to a goat and the goat tested positive for COVID-19. Animal lovers, you'll be glad to know the goat is fine.
Hmm. Well, it's a great point about accuracy there, because the test and the ability to test accurately, that reflects directly in the numbers that we just spoke about, right? And there are issues with these numbers that we've talked about already in the show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. New numbers might arrive even as we're recording this, indicating spikes in some countries or drops in others. And numbers need to be updated for accuracy. And you hit the nail on the head, Matt. That is a huge problem. Are these numbers accurate? It depends on who you ask. The government of China, and not to pick on China too much, this is happening in other places, but the government of China is currently taking a ton of heat internationally because people just don't believe their numbers. And, you know, it's an understandable skepticism because those numbers keep changing.
Yeah. Earlier this month, authorities in Wuhan, where the pandemic began, revised the death toll of that city by more than 50%, while the government in Beijing has continuously denied that there had been any cover-ups in their handling of the virus. And the Department of Homeland Security is reporting a claim that China covered up the severity of the virus from the start in order to better look out for their population by hoarding supplies. And, you know, I mean, in our very first episode about this before it really hit us at home, I think it was very clear that there was, at the very least, a minor cover up in the way they handled the individual who first reported this virus and threatened him with some form of sedition or, you know, spread rumor mongering, I believe it was. So I think there's no question that they definitely were approaching it with some level, whether you could say it was skepticism or outright desire to cover it up. They certainly didn't jump right on it.
Right. Yeah, agreed. And there are also, you know, there are so many ways, devious ways, to gin these numbers up and push them in the direction you want them to go. If you want it to seem less extreme, or as some have proposed, if you're a government that wants it to seem more extreme. Like, what counts as a COVID death? Is a death only COVID related if the person who died had previously tested positive for coronavirus in a test administered by a medical professional? It's tricky, especially in countries like, you know, a lot of sub-Saharan African countries and the U.S., where there aren't a lot of tests. They're in short supply. We know COVID can cause heart attacks. Do people who die of a heart attack after having contracted coronavirus, do they get listed as a COVID death? Or do they get listed as a victim of a heart attack?
Especially if they have, you know, problematic pre-existing conditions, whether it be obesity or sedentary lifestyle or any number of factors that can contribute to having a heart attack.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And then we have to ask about the indirect fallout, which, some people aren't thinking about. And what we mean by indirect fallout is what happens to people who die because something about the pandemic made their life impossible or dangerous. Like if you, to your point about a chronic medical condition, what if you die because your hospital infrastructure is overwhelmed and you cannot obtain, say, insulin or something that you need to live? Is that a COVID-related death? I mean, in this conversation, it sure sounds like it is, but they didn't die from COVID. They died from an overwhelmed system.
That's right. Daniel Weinberger, who's an associate professor of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health, commented that, quote, the assignment of causes of death is more of an art than a science, because it really is sort of in the eye of the beholder, in the same way that the testing is, and also in the same way that you can categorize, for example, the way our president is pushing the line of, well, per capita, our deaths are actually pretty good. And he sort of got railed a bit because he referred to our death toll as being really strong, I believe was the term he used, just in terms of like positivity and spinning it. Because you're right, Ben. I mean, there are so many ways to spin this, and with so many different numbers and so much change happening so quickly, it really is something that can be quite misleading if you don't look at the root cause or don't actually look at the numbers in a more holistic way.
Yeah. It goes down to our understanding of something called excess death. This is kind of cold, but excess death is a term describing the number of deaths in, you know, a given amount of time that occur in excess of the normal established death rate. So researchers over at Yale found 15,400 excess deaths in the U.S. from March 1st through April 4th. That's the early stages of coronavirus really kicking into high gear. During that time, only about half that many deaths have been attributed to COVID. Then this means if we can look at this, if we can trust some of these numbers, the death toll that's official is probably much lower than what's actually happening. How much higher? We don't know. And that should scare people. That should frighten you. The projections also are not set in stone. They're not mandates. Instead, they're like a decision tree. They're fluid branches of if-then decisions. And we have to remember that every choice a policymaker or an institution makes during this time is going to move the prediction in a different direction. And of course, if you've been watching the news in the U.S. or abroad, you know that there are quite a few disagreements domestically and internationally.
Yeah, you've likely seen on the news some of the protests that have been occurring. Michigan, I believe, is one of the major places that these protests have been occurring. But there have been smaller ones across the states. A lot of times you will see these reported on with a bunch of individuals who are brandishing weapons, who are, you know, there to just protest their inability to work. Generally, it has been about getting back to work, like open up, like remove these restrictions so that we can work. And that is a valid thing, you know, that like we've been talking about earlier today about Georgia opening up. It's a valid concern for a lot of people. But there's also the overall dangers, and we're having to, we're obviously disagreeing at the core about this, but we're attempting to find a path, I think, or at least it feels like we're trying to find a path where we're going to be able to open up more of the economy while still staying quarantined to an extent. There's another thing here that we really have to think about is if a lot of people cannot pay rent, and they have no income, they can't pay for bills, what do we do? And so far, as we talked about in previous episodes, the answer has been give a check, you know, for $1,200 or a certain amount of money to each individual. But that's only going to take you so far.
Yeah. Yeah. Because the landlords have to pay rent as well in terms of a mortgage, right? Or taxes. And we know that other countries, such as our neighbors to the north, Canada, have approached the situation much differently. They're issuing payments to people. I think in some cases, in some areas, they're instituting rent freezes, but I don't think it's a countrywide thing. You know, if we look at the international sphere, the way I kind of thought about this is China versus everybody, and the U.S. is sort of a Charlie Day-like wild card from Always Sunny in Philadelphia. China is, make no mistake, taking the opportunity presented by COVID to conspire and expand on some longstanding geopolitical goals. And it is getting ugly. There was a report that came out recently that was internal. It leaked from Chinese intelligence, the Ministry of State Security, writing to top Beijing leaders, including the president, Xi Jinping. They said that global anti-Chinese sentiment is at its highest since the Tiananmen Square crackdown in 1989, and they are preparing for everything up to and including armed conflict between the U.S. and China. That means literally war. They're not declaring it, but they're saying, hey, heads up.
Well, and it wasn't helped by, is the leaked document you're talking about, the Five Eyes report? There was allegedly a leaked Five Eyes report that came out essentially confirming some of the beliefs that have been floating around out there that China did take some of the actions that it had been accused of previously, of kind of covering up the virus that we mentioned earlier in the show. It certainly didn't help that came out at the time when these tensions are continuing to rise, because then it makes, I'm assuming, I don't know about a ton of this stuff, but it's going to embolden the United States to feel like we're in the right to, not only defend ourselves, but to prevent China from taking some of these bigger steps that you're talking about, Ben.
Yep. There's another story that hasn't gotten a lot of play here in the U.S. We don't want to make this myopically about just the U.S. and China. China has also been increasing its attempts to influence Australia in a major way, and they're getting help from Australia's billionaire mining class. There's a guy named Andrew Forrest who recently snuck a Chinese official into a federal-level government press conference after the Australian government had already declined to speak with the guy or have him speak. So it's sort of like, for perspective, it's similar to, say, Elon Musk or Warren Buffett or someone crashing a White House press conference and bringing, one of their international buddies in and saying, hey, can you just speak here? I know that you guys aren't super great friends with Tehran, but can this diplomat that I just brought in speak here? It's stunning. And he's doing it because of mining interests and agreements he has in China.
Yeah. And just to connect it back up to the Five Eyes thing, as a refresher course, Five Eyes are five intelligence agencies of largely English-speaking countries, the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, Australia, and New Zealand. And it's all of those intelligence agencies working together. And there in Australia, it's interesting that was that was the next thing. Australia, we'll see what's going on there.
Yep. And at this point, we said the U.S. is a wild card. Honestly, what else is there to say? It's losing massive ground internationally. Its policies often seem, from the outside looking in, self-contradictory, disparate, mercurial. And that's because, a lot of states are taking their own paths. The line between business and government has eroded. And we have to be honest, it is difficult to keep track of all the conspiratorial narratives out there. They keep growing. Some are more plausible than others. What do we mean? We'll tell you after a word from our sponsor. Here's where it gets crazy. Let's start with big businesses and billionaires.
Ooh, the double B.
The triple B even.
Oh, Bill, Mr. Gates.
Well, Billy. Big business billionaires and Bill.
Oh, God, quadruple B. Oh, there's too many. Yes, Bill Gates. You may have heard quite a few headlines about his foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Yeah, the idea is that they teamed up with a cadre of fellow super wealthy supervillains, and they ran a simulation back in October of 2019 where they predicted 65 million deaths due to COVID-19. Here's the thing. that actually happened. There was actually an exercise. It was called Event 201. I think we mentioned it briefly in a previous episode. It was hosted by the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, and it did focus on emergency preparedness in the event of a severe pandemic, but it did not deal with COVID-19, and it did not make real-life predictions about death tolls. It did deal with a coronavirus, but not this kind, because as we said earlier, there are multiple kinds of coronavirus, just like there are multiple genres of music with drums, multiple kinds of cancer, multiple flavors of ice cream.
Yeah. And just so you know, if you want to delve deep into this, you can. Just use quotations in your search and do Event 201, and you'll find all kinds of stuff. There's, you know, you can see the official documents, the results, the videos that are put out there, people speaking about it. It does feel very creepy, especially if you've been watching this season of Westworld with that giant computer simulation that runs the entire planet. It feels like, hey, maybe Bill and Melinda have access to some giant simulated machine that's going to eventually tell each human what their life cycle is going to be. I mean, but probably not.
If anyone has it, it's them, though. I mean, I would say, yeah.
Well, unless it's our next set of happy billionaires, the Koch brothers.
So the idea here is that the Koch brothers and similar super hard right-wing neo-feudalists are financing the protests that we've been seeing. What do you call that? When you call it crisis actors of some kind? Or we're like not sock puppets, that's exclusively online. But it is the idea that they're in some way financing this to create kind of a bit of a push so that their pals and the corporations that they have stake in don't suffer further economic catastrophe because of this pandemic.
And there has been a lot of catastrophe going around in the business world. Make no mistake there. I don't know if you guys saw the news about J. Crew that just came out, that they're going to be going in there. They filed Chapter 11 bankruptcy.
No, I didn't see that.
Yeah. Yeah, and Madewell, that's one of their brands. But yeah, they're going to be closing a ton of stores, and you know, that's just one company, one clothing retailer, and that's going to be happening a lot more in the near future.
Yeah, the only question is how extreme that trend will become. This is interesting. So are they protest puppet masters? It's true that I would say the majority of those protests to reopen are purposely designed to appear as though they are grassroots. And the question is whether they're being astroturfed. There were a couple of people on Reddit who did some fantastic research into the powers behind these front organizations, right? Open Michigan, Open Maryland. So it's understandable that people might think the Koch brothers are behind this again. Remember, they ran point on the Tea Party protest back in 2009 and 2010, but this one actually seems to be not true. Their main political arm for the Koch brothers is an organization called Americans for Prosperity. Beautiful name, right? Chef's kiss. They rejected the in-person protest. They said, their CEO specifically said, the question is, what is the best way to get people back to work? We don't see protests as the best way to do that. She went on to say, the choice between full shutdown and immediately opening everything is a false choice. So they didn't actually, a lot of times they get rightly vilified, but they didn't actually do this one. Someone else did, and we found out who.
Yeah, and it can apparently be traced back to Betsy DeVos. So don't be fooled by the slightly different names here. We've got Indiana Citizens Against Excessive Quarantine. And then we also have Operation Gridlock Tennessee and other groups that are bankrolled by powerful people. They are the opposite of grassroots. The Michigan Freedom Fund was founded by Greg McNeely, a political advisor to the DeVos family, who has provided financial support to that organization.
But that, but this is one of those things where it doesn't mean Betsy DeVos did it, right? It just means there are connections there. Just pointing that out. Remember that.
Yeah, yeah, you're being fair. That is true. But it does appear to be some astroturfing. There is a possibility that some of those protesters are, in fact, paid to protest. So I would say dig in more, but don't let the easy headlines fool you, especially when there are, frankly, other things to worry about. I'm not saying they're worse, but I'm saying the protests are not the only thing going on. Let's talk about tech companies, you guys. Let's talk about surveillance. Let's talk about tracking apps. They're blowing up in countries around the world.
And I would say there is a genuine, I don't know the correct wording here, but there is good reason to want to have tracking apps when you're inside a pandemic. There is a genuinely good reason to have that because you want to see or to be able to predict whether or not someone is at risk of spreading the virus to someone else or whether or not the individual is going to be, you know, at risk of getting it.
What they're calling contact tracing, right? Like that's like the big, you know, thing that's going to really help stem the tide of this this disease is being able to somehow systematically figure out exactly who's been in contact with whom and then trace that back to the source and then, you know, institute proper testing. That's really the only way to kind of get a handle on this.
Yeah, the motivation is smart. It's something that probably should be done. The problem is in our world of big data, all of this stuff just becomes another data set to track people, to control in a certain way, or the at least to have the information about the individual and then apply it to massive groups and you know, continue going upwards.
It's one of these things we've said, whatever the intentions behind these things are, once you let the badger out of the bag, it's really hard to put it back in, even when conditions get better. So what happens post-corona once these things have been put into place?
Yeah. Yeah, it's an excellent question. Let's go country by country. We talked about it in this past, but we have more details now. So a lot of our fellow listeners in Australia have written in, thank you so much, to talk about something called COVID Safe. It's an app and it uses Bluetooth to record, you know, to keep a record rather of other people with the app who have been in close proximity to you or your phone within the past 21 days. It's modeled on a Singapore's earlier app. The info remains on the phone until a user who tests positive for COVID decides to upload it. And then that information is used to trace the contacts of that infected person. It collects a lot of data. The government says that only state health officials will have access to it, but what does that mean? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, there's no time limit.
Just as a fun aside here, we had a listener from down under write to us, and whenever you sign up for this service, COVID Safe, you get a specialized PIN. It looks like a PIN number, and the PIN number that he was assigned was 666001, and he found that to be amusing.
Spooky!
Yeah.
And so let's go, we mentioned Singapore, right? Singapore's app is the basis for the Australia app. This one had about 20% of the population of Singapore started using it since its launch in April. But the issue here is one of not just privacy, but efficacy, because the number of coronavirus cases during that time shot up from 1,000 to more than 16,000. So it's still a good diagnostic tool. It's just the question is, how effective is it at stopping COVID?
And then you have New Zealand, and as that country comes out of its hard lockdown, it's also going to launch a contact tracing app, but it's the details are a little scarce, so we're not quite clear on how that's going to work. Radio New Zealand has reported that it will update people's details with the Department of Health so they can be contacted directly. But beyond that, very little is known at this stage. And just to piggyback off of that really quickly, even here in Georgia, the Department of Health is doing an outreach kind of situation where they're going door to door and offering antibody test, so people can see if they have contracted it. But obviously, it takes a long time to do that kind of outreach because it's very hands-on, very one-on-one.
Just to take it back to New Zealand really quickly, this is one of the first countries to declare that they eradicated coronavirus within their country's boundaries. They made that announcement, I think, on the 30th of April, but then it was found that there were several cases that actually arose after they made that announcement. But it is one of the first places where the heavy restrictions on travel with like to New Zealand as well as away from New Zealand, it really did seem to stop the virus in its tracks pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Like Madagascar in pandemic.
Yeah,
or exactly. Greenland.
But also New Zealand isn't like a super densely populated country. I mean, I think we said like in a previous, it was a Ridiculous History episode. We were talking about exploding pants because of a chemical that was used to eradicate a type of weed that was killing off grass that cows would feed on. The number of sheep, I think, outnumber humans in New Zealand.
Yeah, it's about 6-1. Is the number that gets thrown around.
But they have a ton of people coming in through that country
absolutely.
Every year. Right?
No, but to your point, Matt, that obviously was a smart move for them to institute that so quickly and effectively, that travel ban.
One of the things that you need to know, fellow listeners, is this. New Zealand also is currently harboring a lot of people who've gotten in on golden ticket passports. That's where you get citizenship just based on an investment that you make. And you're essentially buying citizenship. And right before this hit, as it was hitting, some of the people who were in the know ducked off to New Zealand, where they already lived on property that they had bought months or years ago, specifically for its isolation and its potable water. Neil Gaiman is currently in New Zealand, but I think he just got caught there, with bad luck. But Neil's fine, and I don't think he was part of the billionaire elite escape plan.
But he's probably safer than most of us.
Yeah, or is he? Because, you know, one thing New Zealand can't do is change its proximity to China. China is probably the most solid example of how extreme these apps can be, and they can become this way. It's the hardcore one. This app is mandatory. It is tied to your ID. It governs where you can go through QR scanners and a color system. If you're clear, you're green. If you're yellow or amber, you need to isolate. If you're red, you've either been confirmed positive or you've been in close contact with someone who has tested positive. So that means that unless you stay inside all of the time, you could turn red at any time. And you need this app, by the way, to travel anywhere. You need it to get into venues. And now those restrictions are starting to ease. But that is real Black Mirror stuff. It's happening now. This can happen. It's not Blade Runner. People can do this to you now.
Ben, do you think the infrastructure of this was in some ways helped by the Sesame credit situation that was sort of being tested?
Yeah, that's a great question. I assume that they have some of the same architecture. They would have to, and it stems from some of the same ideology and goals. Definitely, Sesame credit's still in full effect. That's a very good point.
And I will say this is a hot take, and I'm half joking when I say this, but I can't think of another situation than this that has had more net positives from being a totalitarian government, because they can actually force you to behave and force you to do what's best for the masses as opposed to the individuals, like we're seeing with all the people just coming out en masse based on the concept of opening back up the economy.
I would just say there's less manipulation required, and you can be a little more straightforward when you're authoritarian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't have to worry about the Overton window. You don't have to, have offline conversations with your pals in the media. India, France, Israel, Germany, the United Kingdom, South Korea, everybody has either instituted a system like this or they're planning to do so. Israel's having some difficulties because of the privacy concerns. Now, we've talked a lot about these tracking apps in other countries, but what about the good old United States, apple pie, bald eagles, freedom in all caps, underlined, highlighted, a couple exclamation marks to really make it pop? We'll tell you after a word from our sponsor.
Okay, now to be fair, we aren't just talking about the U.S. here. What we're about to discuss it's really a baseline version of an app that will be instituted or can be instituted in any country that chooses to adapt it. So let's jump to on April 10th when Apple and Google announced that they were going to be working together and using the smartphone tech for, you know, both Apple iPhones, the iOS stuff, as well as Android operated phones to help track COVID and the spread of COVID in the same way we've been discussing before. Just like the first one that we talked about in Australia, COVID Safe, this version is going to use Bluetooth or the Bluetooth 4.0 low energy. They're going to use that tech to keep track of mobile phones and proximity, just which phones come into close contact with each other. And that's really all you're talking about here. That's everything that this app is meant to do.
Is this an advancement of the website that Google was supposedly working on that Trump kind of prematurely announced early on, saying that developers at Google were hard at work creating some kind of database, and then turned out that they barely had begun work and it wasn't really as much of a thing as he maybe made it out to be? Is this sort of the next gen of that announcement?
This is an evolution of that. Yes, correct. Early on, it was, you know, people were touting that it was going to use GPS technology to actually trace where people were going once they've, you know, contracted COVID-19. As of right now, as of today on May 4th, the official word is that it's just going to be using Bluetooth data and proximity, and it won't be collecting GPS data or location services data.
Much less in real time. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this has brought up these grave concerns. I mean, here's how it works, right? It keeps track of who you know, and then let's say you test positive for COVID-19, and then it uses that information to go back and tell everybody that you plausibly could have run into, and then also helps to try to trace when you may have contracted it and how. But as you can imagine, not everybody's happy with this. The two big questions: how effective will this actually be? And then secondly, how does it affect what's left of privacy?
Yeah, Jennifer Granick from the ACLU, who heads up their surveillance and cybersecurity program, notes that contact tracing is only one piece of the puzzle, which I think is fair, saying that it can't be fully effective, quote, until there is widespread, free, and quick testing and equitable access to healthcare. I think that healthcare piece has been something that really has been highlighted by this pandemic, how disparate the availability of healthcare is depending on who you are and who you work for and the economic strata that you find yourself in. It's really pointed a glaring finger. Can a finger be glaring? I don't know. But just at that problem in our country, there really is no... I was about to say universal healthcare, which is true, but there really is no equitable access to healthcare in this country. I don't think anyone would argue with that too hard.
No, absolutely not. I mean, that's a reality. Let's look at how this will roll out. Despite the fact that, to Jennifer Granick's point, the U.S. does not have the infrastructure to get the most use out of this, the companies, Google and Apple, are planning to roll this out in two phases. First, they're releasing software this month to let public health authorities build and release apps on Android and on Apple. And then in the coming months, they'll move to phase two. Phase two is where Google and Apple build this function directly into the operating system. You heard that right. It's being built into the OS on your phone. Doesn't matter if you download the app. It doesn't matter if you love or hate the app. It will be on your OS. No one's sure what happens. To all that surveillance, all that data, once it's gathered, does it just vanish post-COVID? Google recently made an announcement about this, or I think Google and Apple jointly made an announcement.
Yeah, they independently sent out a couple, or sent out announcements about this thing. So here's the big takeaway that they keep pushing on, that concept that they're not going to collect location data using this. It's not going to be used for this at all. And they're not going to be using the data collected for targeted advertising. And I think the most positive thing going here is that, well, it's positive and negative. It's positive for privacy. It's negative for the effectiveness of the app. Because each individual person is going to have to upload or confirm that they have tested positive for coronavirus. So it's not as though it's going to automatically upload when let's say Matt, when I contract coronavirus, I get tested, I find out, you know, through the test that I have definitely contracted it. It's not going to then connect my phone, my device to my identity and upload that I am coronavirus positive. I have to then go in through the GUI or through the app and then upload or confirm my test, which, because there's each coronavirus test will have a number essentially generated and associated with it. You have to confirm that. Then that gets sent out to everybody that has come into contact with my phone over the course of, you know, whatever that time window is, let's say 2 weeks, like Ben and Noel and my wife and all of my friends that I've talked to, which I haven't really seen anybody in the past 2 weeks, but they would all get notified that perhaps they came into contact with someone, would not identify me, with coronavirus.
Yeah, yeah, that's correct. So you can see how there's an effort toward anonymity here. And, you know, you can believe Google and Apple when they say they won't ask for certain things or they won't share them if they get them, because, you know, a company is able to get rid of data if they want. They are able to avoid collecting certain things. They can do whatever they want with it unless they are legally compelled to do or not do something. And that brings us to one of the big worries, which is the government, Big Brother. Let's say that Google and Apple are acting in good faith. Let's say that they have, you know, an app called, called America Breathe Easy or something. And that's too long.
How about America Breezy?
There we go. Yeah, America Breezy. And so they have America Breezy, and they're collecting this data, and their plan is to chunk it, like to brick it afterwards. But legislation requires them to hand it over. You see, Big Brother, whether that's the U.S. or whether that's, it doesn't matter, whichever country, Nepal, Bhutan, it doesn't matter. Big Brother is there and is able to use this opportunity to get sweeping surveillance powers. It is naive, extremely so, to assume that every country granting itself sweeping surveillance powers is actually going to give them up after this is over, after it normalizes. In fact, if, you know, some people might call this too far out there, too tinfoil hatty, but it is plausible that several of these capabilities for widespread monitoring already existed. A global pandemic is just the perfect opportunity that happened along, and now governments can go public with stuff they already had. Now tech companies can go public with stuff they already had. I am personally, just my opinion, I'm personally certain that's the case in the U.S. The NSA, as we know, as you know, longtime listeners, the NSA and various other organizations here, including Five Eyes, can do way more than is publicly admitted.
Yeah, we know this. I mean, we absolutely know this from what we know about the giant data facilities that were built in Utah and what the NSA was using them for, because people leaked information about it. We found out about that, I think, about how long ago that was, Ben, when we were talking about that, and how we've just kind of forgotten, or at least just choosing to not think about it, because it makes me feel a little better when I don't think about it. Yeah, you make a great point, and I'm trying very hard to stay positive here. So maybe not.
We'll have updates, by the way, in a future episode very soon on Julian Assange and Edward Snowden. Don't think they are forgotten. And maybe that Russian spy, you know, I think she got back. She's out of prison. But you're right. Will these remain post-pandemic? The answer is this: unless there are specific sunset laws put into place, then absolutely. Unlike tech companies, the government has yet to issue an official statement about this to the public, which means that for right now, unless something changes, if privacy is Elvis and America is a building, then Elvis has left the building or is on the way out.
Oh my God. Well, here's the positive. If there is ever a pandemic of some sort, or even an outbreak that is more isolated to one section of one country or, you know, a cluster of countries, you could use this infrastructure to help from the jump. And that could be a good way of perhaps avoiding the economic downturn that we're experiencing right now, if that was there and it was only being used for positive means to trace an outbreak like this. That's the one silver lining I can imagine.
Well, that's the thing. Privacy versus safety, right? Or liberty versus safety.
Yeah. And speaking of things people have more or less forgotten about, how about the election that's coming up?
Oh, right.
It just seems so bottom of mind given everything that's going on, which is messed up to say the least. But yeah, there still are increasing concerns swirling around whether the government will use COVID as a way to essentially change the nature of or delay elections. This is spreading through all political walks of life in the U.S., and there's a handful of potential concerns. Does mandatory mail-in voting constitute a poll tax? That's interesting. Does mandatory in-person voting constitute a health risk? Two sides of the same coin. Will the November presidential election be delayed?
Or not happen?
I mean, they delayed Bonnaroo, so I mean, who's to say they can't delay the election, you know?
Dragon Con.
Right, right. It certainly does not seem out of the realm of possibility, and it seems like the kind of thing that could be very easily justified as a very reasonable measure to take to keep people safe. But is there nefarious intent behind it? That's the thing.
Right, right. What is the intent? And also, this is an interesting one. This one that's gained a lot of popularity recently. It's the concept of the distraction. What if instead of being underreported, COVID numbers, the death rates, the contraction rates, what if they're actually being inflated? If so, why? This argument is pretty popular in various groups. The idea here is that a great deal of the COVID worry is either in part or in full an intentional effort by media and various governments to distract the public from other pressing issues, such as, you know, an election, or to allow a government more breathing room to institute massive surveillance capabilities without all the debate, conversation, and criticism that would normally happen. I mean, this is an interesting one. We noted the inherent opportunism. There's no question that people are taking advantage in tremendously unethical ways, but you know, when we talk about this, we have to ask ourselves the same question you ask whenever you see a government messing up. Is this out of ingenious, insidious design? Or is this out of, you know, garden variety incompetence, the kind you can encounter at street corners and all-you-can-eat buffets the world over? I don't know. If we walked through it, I think we could find arguments for both sides. But as far as inflating the numbers, one of the other arguments would be that the numbers are being inflated to prevent them from reaching a catastrophic point. I don't know. What do you think? What do you guys think on this?
The narrative I've seen floating around is that the numbers are being inflated to cause enough fear in people to self-quarantine, even if there are, you know, if there are orders from your, let's say, your state's governor or the president himself that you have to quarantine, not everybody is going to listen to that. But if the death toll and the numbers are scary enough, then people will do it because they feel like they're protecting themselves and their families. That's the narrative I've seen floating around. I do not believe this to be true, though I do know psychologically that would be correct, right? It's like psychologically you would have an effect on people if if you made the numbers higher than they were and you made it more scary, you get everyone to comply the way the majority of people, at least in the United States, have been complying.
That would be a pretty generous and magnanimous use of that kind of inflating, though, I would say, right? Like,
well,
with the best interest of people's health in mind, we're talking also about versions of it that are much more self-serving, you know, right?
Yeah. The nefarious part to that, generally to that narrative, is that the economy is being crashed purposefully to either bring in, you know, to kill cash essentially, or to cause a revolution within the United States and abroad.
Ooh, I love it. You know, Iran, just before the latest attempted Venezuelan coup, Iran went in and cleaned out some of their gold bars because oil countries are in a fix right now. So this, speaking of narrative, this brings us to something that I know a lot of us were hoping to hear on today's episode, and that is this. Recently, the current president of the United States made international headlines when he stated that he had proof positive of some sort that convinced him this coronavirus did indeed come from a laboratory, that same laboratory that we mentioned way back in our first COVID episode. But keep in mind, this contradicts several other findings, including those from some U.S. departments and intelligence agencies. When asked to describe this proof or to speak more about it, the president said, this is a quote, he said he wasn't allowed to. That could be taken to mean there were security concerns, right? If there is something more to this story, it could fundamentally alter our understanding of the situation. And again, if that sort of proof does exist, going public with it could expose the U.S. intelligence apparatus at play. You know, spies could get compromised. People would learn about tech that maybe they weren't supposed to know about. But that would be that. Like, that's the, if we're making an assumption, right? If we're assuming that there is something real there, then that would be the first reason not to reveal it. But no one else has confirmed this. There's no second source coming out and agreeing with it at this point.
Yeah, and I would just say we have seen similar statements like this that appear to be akin to, hey, I've got some really important information, but I can't tell you about it yet.
Yeah, I got a girlfriend. You wouldn't know her. She goes to a different school.
She's from Canada. I swear she's real though. She's absolutely, absolutely real. Her name is Tess.
And that's not to say that the president isn't, maybe he does have some kind of highly classified thing, but I totally agree with you, Ben, about how it's, it just seems like a poor move, in general.
And we're waiting to hear more as that story develops. But again, to be absolutely fair, if it is true, then that is a powder keg of a development there. One last one today, as we've just sort of skimmed across a wide variety of things. You may have heard that a book by fiction author Dean Koontz predicted coronavirus. The Eyes of Darkness, if you read one of the paperback editions now, you'll see that it's a story about something called Wuhan 400, a coronavirus, a pandemic that spreads across the world. However, that's not what it originally said. If you look at the first printing, it was called Gorky 400, and they changed it to Wuhan 400. Yeah.
Oh, talk about 80s. Opportunism.
No, they didn't change it to Wuhan 400 in 2019.
Though. Okay. Well, still, it's still somewhat predicting it, or at least some clever, you know, copy editor predicted it. He's got a lot of Eyes of books. Doesn't he have a book called Eyes of the Dragon as well? Is that?
That's Stephen King, I think, isn't it?
No, it's Dean Koontz. Let's see. Eyes of the Dragon is by Stephen King. You're damn right, Dean Ben.
But, Twilight Eyes.
Okay.
He made Twilight Eyes.
Is that the only other Eyes book he has?
I don't know. He's got a lot of books.
Yeah, he does have a lot of books. I remember Hideaway. Remember Hideaway, Ben? That was about a satanic Satan-worshipping serial killer, and there was a movie where Jeremy Sisto played that character. Jeremy Sisto famously played the unhinged boyfriend of Claire on 6 Feet Under. He's kind of like a kooky artist guy. He was also in Clueless, I want to say, but that guy always played like kind of an unhinged character. But that was an interesting movie. That's so crazy that they changed. I wonder what their motivation was for changing the text.
Well, originally the virus, I believe in the first printing from 81, it was, I think, a Russian town. Maybe that's incorrect. I want to say it was a Russian town where the virus originated. That's
Gorky Park is a famous Russian amusement park, I believe, that is a place you can visit still where it's sort of been ravaged by radioactivity from Chernobyl, I believe.
Mm. So it came out in 1981, it was Gorky, and then when it was released again in 1989, it was changed to Wuhan. So that's, I don't know, myth busted. It's interesting to think about. And Dean, if you're listening, keep it up, man. Let us know about your next projects. Speaking of things that are next, this is our show for today, and we have to leave it to you. What do you think is going to happen next? Are we going to see a spike in deaths? Are we going to see a decline in deaths? Are we going to see that these numbers and the origin story of coronavirus are, in fact, fabrications? I don't know.
Yeah, we're just gonna have revelation after revelation, I'm pretty sure, every week, every day moving forward. And there's gonna be a ton for us to talk about, especially once all of us have our iOS or Android devices letting us know all the people we've come into contact with coronavirus.
And as it stands right now, I don't believe any of us have gotten the test, whether an antibody test or a test to see if we're currently infected. Because I think here in Atlanta, we are pretty lucky that a few places are making those tests available, and the criteria for getting one has started to loosen in the past few weeks, where you can, that promise that the president made early on, where anyone who wants a test can get a test, is starting to be a little more true, but still not, as true as it maybe should be.
I would say, in a positive and scary thing, Waffle House's reopened in Georgia. And guys, I went to one. I walked into a Waffle House and picked up my to-go order. It was pretty scary, but it was not crowded. But they were taking a lot of steps, I would say, to make me feel safe as the customer, as well as keep their employees safe. It was actually, it was great.
What did you get?
All-star special, dude. Come on.
Does that include a waffle?
It does, with some pecans in it, baby.
Yeah, so hopefully everybody knows this, but here in the American South, a Waffle House closing down is a huge deal. In fact, for a while, FEMA unofficially used Waffle House closures as a measure of disaster severity.
Yeah.
The Waffle House Index.
Exactly.
One last little update, by the way, I don't know if you guys saw this, but Billboard magazine recently put out an article saying Missouri governor says concerts can resume Monday. Missouri governor Mike Parson has given the okay for concerts to begin again as early as Monday, as long as certain social distancing measures are taken. I don't know how you do that at a concert properly. That does seem tough.
Well, let's keep an eye on Missouri and see what happens in the next 2 to 3 weeks with it. And we also want to hear what's happening in your neck of the global woods. Let us know, do you think COVID is overblown? Do you think it's underestimated? And let us know what you think life post-pandemic will be like. You can tell us about it on Instagram. You can find us on Facebook. You can talk to us on Twitter, where we are Conspiracy Stuff on Twitter and Facebook, and Conspiracy Stuff Show on Instagram.
If you wish, you can find us as individual human people. Follow our quarantine adventures. You can find me exclusively on Instagram. I am at @HowNowNoelBrown.
And until the black bag gets me, you can find me on Twitter, where I'm Ben Bolin HSW. You can find me on Instagram, where I am at Ben Bolin. I'm getting back into painting again. I guess I'll just, it'll be very on brand for me to paint some badgers. So maybe I'll send those along to you guys online.
Nice. And you can always find me at Dean Kunst Official on Instagram. I'll be there just showing you all the books that I've got. Really great books. Hideaway
Kunst!
Is one of them. Also devoted. Just check it out. Oh, hey, and another one about eyes, Noel, for you. My work, From the Corner of His Eye.
Thanks, Dean.
And if you don't want to find me on Instagram, again, Dean Kuntz Official, you can always give me a call, as well as the rest of the guys here. Our number is 1-833-STDWYTK. You can leave a message, tell us how you're doing, what you're thinking, something you want us to cover, something you want us to stop doing. There have been a few messages coming our way lately that have been like, hey, you're pronouncing this wrong. Stop doing that. So you can do that. That's fine. It doesn't hurt us that much. Maybe our feelings a little bit, but we'll be okay.
And if you don't want to do any of that stuff, you can send us a good old-fashioned email where we are.
Conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.